Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Anne Lamott, whose latest novel is Blue Shoe. Previous book is Traveling Mercies, Some Thoughts on Faith. Anne Lamott, do you find it easier to write fiction or nonfiction?
Oh, I think it's a lot easier to write nonfiction for me. First of all, a lot of the pieces in Traveling Mercies were written at Salon, due on a Friday and started on a Monday, and 5 or 6 pages. And so there was sort of immediate gratification. But the same process, horrible first draft, all is doomed, it's all over, it's hopeless, this will never work. And then Tuesday, cleaning it up and editing and taking a lot of stuff out. And then Wednesday, having a really workable draft and so on. A novel, for me, usually close to 3 years from start to finish. And so it takes a lot more stamina.
In the realm of nonfiction, and you've written several books of nonfiction, including Operating Instructions, what happens when your friends or relatives see the book? Because I know when you write fiction, you can disguise it and people don't recognize themselves. But when you're writing this, I mean, what happens? Does somebody say, how dare you say that?
Well, almost everything in Traveling Mercies that's about the family, except for the piece on my mother, is pretty flattering. I mean, I'm not stupid. I've lived in the same county in Marin my whole life, and I'm 48. I've lived there 48 years, and all of my family lives there, and so I go out of my way to write stuff about them that they won't mind, because I think it must be kind of a nightmare to have a writer in the family. The people that I wrote articles about that are less than flattering, I definitely made them into composites to protect their privacy, too. Like the woman on the forgiveness piece who had so much concern that Sam wasn't reading, I changed every telling detail about her but kept the truth of the story really impeccable.
Did she have any sense? Or
none. No, none. And that's the thing with novels, too, is that if you disguise a couple of details about people, they have no idea that you've just written about them. And, in fact, if you make them just if it's an intolerable or bossy, controlling person, and you change their party affiliation or their hair color, they'll tell you they know someone just like that.
Your son, Sam, who's now what, 14?
13.
He appears a lot in Traveling Mercies. Mm-hmm. Did he have any problem with any of the pieces showing up?
No, but he doesn't read very much, so it hasn't come up. But most of the pieces are just about the kind of heartbreaking love that a parent feels for a child. And so even when there are small moments of difficulty, they're not pieces of anything but love and parenting.
When you're writing fiction, mm-hmm. switching over, and you begin to create your composite characters, do you see the character at first as a whole, or do you kind of draw different elements in?
In Blue Shoe, for instance, with the main character, Maddie, she is really so me. She's really entirely me except for her biography. Her life didn't really unfold the way mine did, and the things that happened to her didn't really happen. And I have a lot of very, very intimate friends and a lot of relatives and a career and all sorts of things she doesn't have. But emotionally and spiritually and psychologically, she's definitely me. So that wouldn't be a problem. Now, Harry, who's the little boy in the book, is not at all like Sam. Sam is pretty easygoing, and he hasn't been through a divorce. In fact, he's quite close to his father, who lives in Canada. But Harry, Maddie's little boy, is a child of a divorce, and it's making him a little crazy. My mother died of Alzheimer's last year, and so the mother, Issa, Maddie's mother, is based quite a lot on my mother, but with a different personality. But the conflict between the mother and the daughter, and a daughter having to be the parent to a mother who was not a very effective mother, is really my own predicament. So there weren't very many characters in Blue Shoe that I didn't like, so I didn't have to change very many telling characteristics.
So in that sense, what you're doing is you're taking yourself, putting yourself in new situations, and then just going with the way you'd react.
No, I don't think that's true.
No?
Really at all. I think it's different, and I'm not sure if I can capture that. But I'm not just taking me. Somebody comes to me, in this case Maddie Ryder, and she's just gotten divorced, which I have never gotten. And I'm not trying to imagine what it would be like for me if I went through divorce or my husband was unfaithful or I had two little kids instead of one. Instead, this character comes, and she's physically and, as I said, biographically very different from me. And I start at that point to try to get to know her. I start trying to listen and to pay attention. In the first draft, I keep trying to get these characters to say things that I've said or friends have said because they would be so witty or brilliant. And then in the second draft, I take a lot of that stuff out because it doesn't ring true. It would ring true for me and my friends. Jessica Mitford said you had to kill your little darlings in the editing process, and that means taking out a lot of the stuff that you love the most because it doesn't ring true, and that's certainly the hardest part for me, but also why anything ever works at all.
And as you said with in discussing Salon, at the beginning you're looking at this shapeless mess that you think will never be a book, and eventually it becomes a book, and that happened here too?
Well, as I said, Maddie kind of appeared fully formed inside of me, and there also was a little blue shoe in my life 20 years ago that I still have that was something a friend and I just kept passing back and forth when one of us would get into a bad patch of time and emotion. And I'd always thought it would be a great way to tell the story of a friendship over a number of years. So I began with that, and then I started to see Maddie, and then real life would come up, like I had rats in my walls, and so pretty soon I was just writing about rats because it was funny and nuts and crazy, and because I think mentally I was having rats at the time too. And then I called an exterminator who came over and killed the rats, although I do want to say that I tried every hippie left-wing progressive route to the rat extermination that I could. This was about 7 years ago, including the have-a-heart traps, which have never, ever trapped a single rat. And finally I had somebody come over, and he killed the rats, and I never saw him again. Now, in Blue Shoe, at the beginning of the second chapter, Maddie opens up the door, and there's someone who's been summoned to come dispose of the rats, and he doesn't have what it takes to be an evergreen rat man, but he does come into the house to use the phone, and at that point he enters her life. So it's not like all this formless stuff that
right.
I'm trying to quilt together, but it's sort of like, oh, it's like lily pads I keep landing on. I'm getting to know Maddie more. The first chapter, we get to see her kids and the trauma that they're in and the kind of angry contempt with which she holds her husband and his cute new 15-year-old girlfriend and the mother and what a wild, rich, important person she's been in the community and what it's like now that she's shrinking and her mind is deteriorating. And we get to meet all of these people and see where we are, which is usually, you know, always Marin for me in the Bay Area. And then, you know, at the end of the first chapter, the doorbell rings and the evergreen rat guy is there. And as we find out, he just doesn't have what it takes. Then what happens? Well, what's the next lily pad they land on? They start to get to know each other. How do you get to know someone? You ask questions, you spend time together, you listen.
So by that point, did you have any vague idea or specific idea of where the novel was going? Or did you just kind of go then lily pad to lily pad and suddenly you see the far shore nearing?
Well, I knew that it involved the mystery and that a little blue shoe was kind of the MacGuffin of it, that the blue shoe is a little tiny rubber eraser like High Top Ked that's found in some of her father's belongings, like his library card, his registration, his driver's license, and then this dumb little blue shoe. So I knew somehow the blue shoe was a part of the father's past and therefore a part of Maddie's, but I didn't quite know what it all led to.
When you're writing, what kind of role does your own state of mind play in the writing? Can you maintain that even keel in the book, or when you get angry, do you find a place to let go, to let your anger out there? How does that work?
Well, it might not happen in the day's writing where I'm sitting down for a few hours trying to get that morning's work done, but if stuff is happening inside of me that's either very painful or strikes grief into me or that I'm furious about, I always get it down somewhere. I might just scribble notes or just sort of start a file, because usually where I get my sense of humor back is in conveying it. But usually I would convey it to a friend, like some story of incredible aggravation or the story of Issa shopping in this book, Blue Shoe, took place with my mother, and at the time it was not funny. I mean, I really did want to go to the housewares department and get a hammer and smack her over the head, but I ended up calling my younger brother, and we ended up just roaring about it, and it started to become a story that was very funny instead of just about rage and, you know, frustration with my mom. So I get my work done every day, really, no matter what mood I'm in, but I don't write about the mood that I'm in necessarily when I'm in front of the typewriter.
At what point do you do research? Do you do specific research for the book at that point? Do you drive around Marin and find the places that you're going to write about?
No, sometimes I know that I just want to be here or there. I did go to this that one facility where I think there's where Maddie goes with her brother that's supposed to be for people with Alzheimer's but high functioning, and I think it's a hilarious scene in the book, but it's pretty unhilarious in real life. And I took my brother and I took another friend. I really believe in letting friends go to these field trips with me, and so I'll go out to Marshall where a certain amount of the plot unfolds, and I'll go to this great mother redwood tree out at Samuel P. Taylor, and I go out there alone with my notepad, and I'll take a friend out and say, what do you see? What do you smell? What does it feel like to you? And I'll get it all down, and it'll be kind of like pulling rich, dark, wonderful mud out of a river and then starting to shape it on the table into that section. But I took Mark Childress, the great Southern writer, out to Marshall one day for 'cause so much takes place out there. And he just had these incredible ideas and thoughts and things that he would point out that I hadn't seen the first two times.
Anne Lamott, author of Blue Shoe. Let's switch for a moment to your book, Traveling Mercies.
Okay.
You're the first born-again Christian I've read or seen who is not a right-winger by any stretch of the imagination.
I think born-again has gotten attached to me because it's a shorthand for saying that I converted rather late in life and, in fact, drunk. But all of my friends are hardcore left-wing progressives, and I'm a hardcore left-wing progressive. And I would say most of them have a God in their life. I would say none of them are New Age. A number of them are old Berkeley radicals, some of whom have found churches, some of whom go to church, but in some way have a spiritual connection or a path. The people at my church are, except for one or two people, are all very, very committed Democrats and progressives.
Well, what happens when you see all of these people doing these things and saying these things in the name of Christianity? Does it bother you?
Well, it's not really my problem or anything that I can have. I probably have the same reaction that you would have, which is that I'm just horrified by the Christian right, and I've certainly been beat up over the years by the Christian right and attacked. And if I do live radio shows, I get lots of calls that usually have to do with how I'll be burning in hell for all eternity, and I may think I'm so witty right now, but how funny will it be when the flames, etc. But I imagine that my reaction to the Christian right is exactly the same as yours, and I think also people would be surprised by what a very, very beautiful, rich Christian left there is, that there are people that are working for peace and justice and humanitarian rights and environmental rights who have found churches. Many people who come to my lectures and talk sort of whisper to me that they go to church also. They used to always whisper that they were sober, because I'm pretty publicly sober for 16 years. And now they just are so relieved that you get to be a really mixed kind of person, good and bad and secular and a mess and angry and political and unmarried but still really, romantically committed to people, and that you get to really feel beloved by Jesus or feel some sort of feel a deep connection, and that it's all fine. And they come up and they whisper to me that they go to church too. And in Waco, they came up to me and whispered that they're Democrats, so that was sort of funny. But usually they whisper their sobriety date, or they whisper gratitude that they were raised in repressive fundamentalist homes and didn't think they'd ever love God again, and that they never, ever thought they could be in it. They were surprised to find themselves in a church, and that they love that I'm so black-humored and irreverent, but really so devout.
You're listening to an interview with Anne Lamott, whose latest novel is Blue Shoe. Have you thought much about this relationship between spirituality and your own view of it, and say what's happening in the world and how people take it? Do you think it has to do at all with religion then, or is something else going on?
Well, I think the fundamentalism in all of the different religious traditions is really just at the root of this total pandemonium and chaos. Certainly the fundamentalist Christianity of our current administration is devastating. So I do think fundamentalism is just a very, very sickening position to take. I'll tell you a great joke if I have the time.
You have the time.
this man has died and gone to heaven and is being shown around by his angel, and the angel saying, oh, there's trees over there and there's water here, there's surf there, and come over here, look, there's hillsides and lots of people there, quiet space and a glade, and here there's music and here there's silence. And he's going on, and the man, the recently deceased, says, but what's that walled off brick fortress over there? And the angel says very nonchalantly, oh, that's where we put the fundamentalists. It's not heaven for them if they think anyone else got in. You know, and I think one of the reasons that Christian Wright so attacks me is because I think everyone gets in. I think when that woman, Susan Smith, released the handbrake on her car that sent those two little children to their death in the river, that she was loved as much as I am when I'm at the convalescent home holding hands with someone I'll never see again. And I don't understand the mystery of God, but I live in it. And I think that the fundamentalism of all of the major religions is just it's just sickening. It's like a toxic waste dump of madness, and that nothing sweet can thrive in that, because it's all that only you have the truth, and that everybody else should probably be killed or imprisoned, and that God actually supports you killing and imprisoning them.
I remember I have some Mormon friends who said to me at one point, well, don't you want to get into heaven? And I kept thinking, God, if heaven is sort of like Salt Lake City, only without the good parts, no, I don't.
But if heaven's like Park City, you do. Have you ever been to Park City?
Yes,
it's fabulous. I just skied there in April. I think heaven is, I think it's like the song Graceland by Paul Simon, that we're all bouncing into Graceland.
A lot of Traveling Mercies is about forgiveness and learning to forgive and finding a way to forgive. Anne Lamott, could you ever create a character? Have you ever created a character that you can't forgive?
I'd say Blue Shoe is really in a more extended way about forgiveness, actually. There's a piece I love in Traveling Mercies about it, but Blue Shoe is about forgiving a mother who really taught you that you were a mess and that you needed to do certain things in order to be valued and cherished, and who really lived a lie. I have a terrible time with Cheney and Ashcroft and Rumsfeld, and I think Bush is just an idiot, and I don't really hold very much against him. I feel sorry for him. I really do feel like he's been put in this position where it's like as if they wanted him to be a surgeon, and he said he hadn't actually gone to medical school and he'd never done surgery, and they just kept saying, it's really fine, we'll be with you, just do the best you can. Rummy will be there, and Rummy will be doing a lot of it, just show up and scrub up. I have a terrible time with them, the cabinet, really. And but I just don't bog down on it. And C.S. Lewis said, when you start trying to really deal with the possibility of forgiveness, it's better to start with something a little less toxic than the Gestapo. And I certainly see the administration as Gestapo-like. And so, it's hard for me to forgive them. It's hard for me to forgive my mother or me. And so I do it in tiny little bits here and there. I'm able to forgive a little, and I am hoping that is going to be the way to kind of widening concentric circles of compassion.
What is forgiveness?
Well, the old cliche is forgiveness is giving up on having had a better childhood, and it means that you just get it, that everyone did the best they could, and, you know, with what they had to work with, and they actually didn't have that much to work with. They wouldn't get the help they needed. They wouldn't get the psychiatric or medical help they needed, and they really screwed up right and left, but that's just what's true. And so you find yourself at 30 or 40 and 50, and it's like you're like a house on the Russian River where the floodwaters came through and things are buckled and ruined, and a lot of things that were important got wrecked, and people come into it with you, and one day at a time and one box at a time and one square foot at a time, they help you try to restore it, to throw out the stuff that's never going to be salvageable. And I think little by little, forgiveness is about giving up on saving stuff that you thought you needed to become more whole. I don't think we become whole, but to become a little freer, to become less self-obsessed. Forgiveness, I think, the chapter in Traveling Mercies, I wish I'd read it first because then I could answer better, but I know that she sees something about that we're here for giving. We're not here to figure out what we could get that's going to make us more happy. We're here to notice that what we're starved for is what we won't give. So it's for giving. that is our purpose here, but you have to kind of let go of the stuff you've been lugging around with you. And, you know, we all say, I always say that everything I've ever let go of has claw marks on it, and it doesn't go perfectly, but sometimes I forgive somebody a little, and it feels like a miracle. And then maybe I forgive them a little bit more, and then I think, oh, the hell with it, I'm done. I don't want to keep, you know, I don't want to be the Sherpa for something this person did to me, or I perceive them as having done. I'm just done. I don't know how long I'm going to live, but I'm not going to carry this one in my backpack anymore.
But what about the relationship of anger and forgiveness? I mean, to some degree, I figured out with my father, who I've always had a very stormy relationship with, I could forgive him. I knew his background, and I could say, okay. But it didn't necessarily lessen the anger. And you turn it around to somebody like, say, Bush, right? I mean, we could even forgive him for being stupid or, you know, living in kind of a bizarre rich person's monastery. But that doesn't lessen our anger toward what he or his cohorts might do to the world.
Right, but I think there's two different things here. I mean, there's the anger that's sort of tamped down inside of you. It's like a septic leak. You know, it's like something leaching into the field of your day and of your being and of your heart and your worst of all, your mind. And you need. There's no other way but very deep, long-term therapy with somebody you trust to sort of help you bring it up and to feel it. And Sam talks about, my son talks about bed tennis, where you take the tennis racket and you beat the bed and you bring it forth so that you can let go of it. You feel it, you heal it, as that cliche goes. And then there's a kind of what to me is a reasonable and rational longing to be a part of the resistance and opposition in this country to a really sickening totalitarian government that would take us all down. So because they tried to shoot his dad, they tried to shoot my dad, you know. And so there's two different things going on. But the people I know that wish that God or life or their own mind could reach down with a magic wand and tap them, and they let go of the rage they feel at having been abused as children, it's an illusion. It doesn't happen that way. And you can't think your way to it. You don't heal this enraged, wounded mind with your enraged, wounded mind. You need somebody to be a birth coach to something, to some kind of really deep cellular healing of what already happened. But I think forgiveness is moving into the present and taking a long, deep breath. I think rage is fantastically healing. I think rage and grief are the way home. And I think that really is how we find peace in the world, and then we become people of peace. And then it's like Gandhi said, you create what you hope to find. But I'm a great believer. And in fact, Blue Shoe is so much about anger and grief.
There's a lot of rage in the book.
There's a lot of rage. I'm a very angry person. And I think that is because I've been in therapy 15 years. 10 years ago, I couldn't be this angry. I would assume I would get kicked out of the tribe, or that people say, well, you can't actually be a person who talks about God and faith and love and tenderness and trying to be a missionary in the world, which I do try to be, if you're so angry and you have such a black humored sense of humor. And I say, well, did God tell you that? You know, did God tell you? Because when I express my anger at what happened when I was young and at what I see in the world now, which is just this horrible brutality beginning in Washington, D.C., then people are so relieved, and they go, oh, me too. Oh, God, thank you, because you're funny and because you have a really deep faith. And or if I share that I'm so afraid, I'm so worried, and yet I have a very deep faith, people say, they don't say, well, you can't have both. People say, oh, you can't have faith and fear. But courage is fear that has said its prayers and is showing up anyway. And when I express the terror and the grief and the rage, people say, thank you, me too. I don't think that anger expressed at vulnerable people is what we're talking about. I'm talking about this well of rage inside of us that's been bottled up, and that men aren't allowed to show it because then they might lose their jobs or something. Women aren't allowed to show it because they might lose their jobs, or they might look like they're ugly and they're not good flight attendants. But if you want the restoration of your soul, and Blue Shoe is about restoration. It's about finding out who you really were, and you can't do it without finding out why you're so angry and crazy and worried, and why you think that you're such a fraud. And you don't do it by talking to some people whenever you're in the mood to do it. You do it by very, very deep therapeutic healing and possible medication. Blue Shoe is about a woman who's almost 40 who has a history of having had to act only in certain prescribed ways for her to feel that she was of value. This is something very common for women, and I really can't say I know what it's like to be a man. But for women, often we were given the garden. I think everyone's given an emotional garden, and we're given an acre. And we were taught to cultivate the beautiful parts of it, the parts that either fed other people or that were beautiful for cutting flowers or just to be beautiful to look at. And Maddie, in this book, has gotten to the point of grief and anger and lostness that she realizes she just wants her yard back. She wants the whole acre back. She wants the bramble. She wants the weeds. She wants the ugly parts. She wants the wood pile. She wants the parts that people have left rotted, rusty car parts on. And some of that is her ugly, angry, terrified, grief-struck self, and she gets the help that she needs so that she can say, that part, to reclaim it, will give me life force. Hitting the wall above the children's head because they've been so provocative is not going to bring healing. It may get her attention that there's a lot inside of her that just needs wonderful nurturing and mothering to come back to life, but that those huge feelings give us our creativity. They give us our political activism. They give us our rage, and that then leads to doing something for desperately poor people or for the redwood forest. But it's all part of being human, and there's appropriate, and then there's exhilarating, you know, and then there's the part that just is troubled and needs help.
And that part has to be dealt with before it gets out of control. It gets out of control. Do you think people are out of control anymore in this world today than they were, say, 20 years ago?
I'm not sure. That's a good question. I think the country is really terrorized right now by the prospect of war. I think the country's very depressed and flattened right now by fear. It's like rabbits that have a snake poised over it. And so what I'm doing in my travels and my touring and my giving lectures is to say, you know, Augustine said hope is costly, but I have a lot of hope, and the costliness is that you have to sort of feel again, and you have to dare to have some hope that wiser minds or saner minds or sweeter minds will prevail. And what you have to do is to hope that if you show up, like for the big rallies that are planned, or if you do send people money that are working for peace and justice and humanitarian causes, that you really do make a difference. And then it's Mother Teresa saying that you can't do great things. You can't stop the war, but you can do small things with great love. You could send the $100 that you're going to spend on dinner Saturday to Doctors Without Borders or to UNICEF or to whoever you believe is doing really good work in the world. There are things you can do. You can do them every day. I think the country is terribly, terribly depressed. I'm not sure people are more out of control than they were before. I think this is the worst presidency. I mean, this guy's so bad that he's starting to make me nostalgic for Richard Nixon, you know? I look at Richard Nixon and I just picture this horrible kind of troglodyte with a terrible 5 o'clock shadow that I think he had in third or fourth grade. And I remember that Gary Wills book about how he was the kid in first grade with a briefcase, you know, I picture him muttering around the Oval Office, getting loaded on scotch and muttering his anti-Semitic stuff. But it just seems like I feel nostalgic for it when I compare it to Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld.
I keep thinking that at least the Reagans dressed well.
The Reagans did dress well, and the Reagans were pretty good readers, and Bush, I think I said this in the Chronicle on 9/11, but I said to Sam, boy, I'm trying to think of one thing that's really improved since Bush has been in office, because I was asked to write about it, and I said, I think his reading level has improved, and I think he's reading at a 7th or 8th grade level now. And Sam said, no way, 8th grade is really hard, because Sam's in 8th grade. So, I mean, he can't even read. You know, they don't even pretend to need him to make decisions. Like when the World Trade Towers were hit, they didn't even take him out of the second grade room. They didn't get him to stop reading the book. Fran Lebowitz was, because he'd never found out how Pat the Bunny ended. But they didn't bring him out of that classroom because they didn't need him for anything, you know. I think this will go down in history as the most toxic, out-of-control, psychopathic government. for a lot of us, it's like we're in an alternative universe where you can't actually believe the day's news. You can do something. You can take care of one another. You can go to the convalescent home. You can send Barbara Lee $100. You can go buy and sign envelopes. You can make time for somebody that nobody else will make time for. I have a lot of hope right now.
You can even subscribe to KPFA.
You can send in money. You can support the people that are trying to disseminate some truth or some sanity or just some quiet explanations of what's really going on behind the patriotic trance that's been created, the sort of Truman Show that's been created of fervor and jingoism.
One final question about that, because I've been fascinated by the relationship of the media to the Bush administration. He got a free ride to get in, and he's still getting a free ride, and I keep saying, the emperor has no clothes. He's never had any clothes.
No.
What the hell is going on with that?
I don't know. I just think they bought him a nice presidency, and he had this brother who did a very effective job, and he had a right-wing Supreme Court that gave him the election, and obviously he didn't win the election, and I don't know. I think the media's been terrorized, too, and at about the point where they might have started saying, okay, it's been a year, it's been 9 months, and let's see, the Dow has only lost 3,000 points so far, and things are kind of catastrophic. At that point, the planes crash into the World Trade Center, and it just has been people holding their breath, walking on eggshells, being so, and everybody being so terrified of losing the election. And about the media, you turn to the same places. You turn to KPFA, you turn to Salon, you turn to The Nation, you turn to McNeil Lair or whatever it's called now, and you turn to NPR, you turn to certain stations and a few people, and you really always did. And the people that were always trying to save the world and the environment and the poor and the destitute and are still trying to save them, and they have been trying to save them more and more vocally since September 11th, and I just feel like it's the plates of the earth have really shifted, and people are showing up, putting their money where their mouth is, and daring to have a little hope again. I'm not convinced we're going to get to bomb Iraq now.
Anne Lamott, you're still writing for Salon.
Well, I haven't been since I was working on Blue Shoe, but when this publicity tour ends, I hope to.
And are you thinking about what your next book will be?
No, I'm thinking about the work that I'm going to do in the fall for the opposition and the resistance. I keep thinking, where's the resistance? But you know what? The resistance is there. It's growing, and people are beginning to breathe again. It's kind of like they're being spritzed by a plant mister, and they're going, wait a minute, I'm not going to go down without, not in my name. It's not going to happen. May happen, but it's not going to happen in my name. And so I'm going to be working for the resistance and the opposition, and I'm going to hope to be working at Salon, writing the pieces I write, which are spiritual and political, and they're about my family. They're about taking care of one another. They're about not giving up and trying to keep my sense of humor, trying to bring thirsty people a glass of water and sit down with them until they feel a little better.
You've been listening to an interview with Anne Lamott, whose latest novel is Blue Shoe. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.